well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Welcome to another edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. My name is Cam Edwards. Glad you're with me on the program today. Now, I said on Monday's show that Jim Wallace of the Gun Owners Action League was going to be with us on the program today, but unfortunately, Jim had a bit of a conflict, so we'll get him back very soon to talk about the latest with Chapter 135, a.k.a. the Devil's Snare, a.k.a. the Lawful Citizens Imprisonment Act, which is partially in effect in Massachusetts. You know, Governor Maura Healey signed that, she signed the bill into law back in July, and then she signed an emergency preamble in early October, putting the law into effect immediately, but we've seen major portions of that law suspended until further notice, right? The new training mandates for would-be gun owners, those seeking a license to carry, that's been pushed back 18 months or so. The firearms roster, which now includes rifles and shotguns for the first time, rifles and shotguns defined as firearms under Massachusetts law, and the roster of guns available for sale does not have any rifles or shotguns. The state said, well, never mind. We know what the law says, but we're not going to enforce that right now just to keep on keeping on. But you can sell rifles and shotguns, just not the evil assault weapon guns. You can't sell those. I mean, it is so confusing. And there are all kinds of issues for hunters, which is what we're going to be talking with Jim about. Because even though this law was billed as, you know, a way to go after violent criminals, a way to improve public safety, it touches every aspect of gun ownership in Massachusetts, including folks who like to travel to the state to do a little bit of hunting, who aren't, generally speaking, armed violent criminals, right? But they are still under the microscope under Chapter 135. So anyway, we'll hopefully get Jim back on the program in the very near future. But on today's program, we're going to be talking about something else going on to the north of Massachusetts in Maine, where on Election Day, gun control advocates headed to the polls, not just to vote, but to collect signatures. You know, in Massachusetts, go back there for just a second, Chapter 135 is being challenged, portions of it in court, but you also saw this grassroots movement in Massachusetts, the Civil Rights Coalition, headed up by Toby Leary, that collected more than 90,000 signatures to put Chapter 135 before the voters. So in 2026, Massachusetts voters will go to the polls, and among the issues that they'll be voting on is the repeal of Chapter 135. Well, in Maine, gun control activists are also trying to use the referendum process, not to protect the Second Amendment, but to impose a new gun control law in the state of Maine, specifically a red flag law. According to the Portland Press Herald, the gun control group Maine Gun Safety Coalition had hundreds of volunteers at more than 100 polling places on Election Day, collecting about 60,000 signatures, they say, of voters who support a red flag law. The coalition announced the ballot initiative in mid-September needs at least 67,682 registered voter signatures to force the legislature to either pass the law or send it to a statewide referendum. Palmer said petitioners reported overwhelmingly positive interactions with voters across the state, something she said she personally experienced while collecting signatures outside of a polling location in Topsom, Maine. Palmer said she received support from a wide variety of voters, including Republicans and gun owners. She says that we're not surprised that Maine voters had an overwhelming positive response on Tuesday and are ready to bring this common sense policy to the ballot to save lives. A lot of people who want to make sure that they're doing what they can to keep our communities safe. Well, listen, I got to say, I'm not particularly surprised that they were able to collect a lot of signatures. I doubt very much that the voters who signed their name to that petition got a very detailed synopsis of what a red flag law would entail from the Maine Gun Safety Coalition. So even if a red flag bill is polling, and I don't know what the numbers would be, but let's say it's polling at 60%, 70%. That doesn't mean that's what the referendum is going to look like. You know, in 2016, gun control activists had another referendum in Maine. This one to impose universal background checks. And again, in the pre-election polling, about two-thirds of Maine voters said that they supported universal background checks. But when the votes were actually tabulated, only 48% of voters in Maine actually wanted to adopt universal background checks, and that referendum failed. So why was there the disparity? Well, I suspect that, again, as people became more aware of how that law would be enforced, what all of the particular provisions looked like, and they realized, oh, this isn't about stopping violent criminals from getting a hold of guns illegally. This is about me not being able to sell my gun to my neighbor without the two of us driving 40 miles to the nearest gun store so that a background check could be performed on the guy that I know for 20 years. And again, when it comes to the red flag law, I'm confident that a lot of voters in Maine don't really understand what a red flag law looks like, especially when the state already has what's called a yellow flag law. Now, Palmer says that the gun control group has not decided whether to pursue a referendum in November of this year or next year, or 2026, rather, when Maine voters will elect a new governor. The group hopes to collect at least 75,000 signatures before submitting them to the state, just to be sure it exceeds the threshold, she told the Portland Press-Herald. Waiting until 2026 would give lawmakers time to try to pass a version of a red flag law and avoid what she calls a costly voter referendum campaign. Palmer said if we were to hold off until 2026 and the legislature got it done in 2025, then it would obviously make it moot. So now we know what one of the big to-do items is going to be for gun control advocates in Maine next session, right? And they introduced a red flag bill this past session, but it did not get to Governor Janet Mills' desk. Governor Mills had indicated she was not in favor of replacing the state's yellow flag law with a red flag law. So what's the difference between the two? Well, with a red flag law, and again, there is no federal statute, so states can come up with their own extreme risk protection order language, and it may vary from state to state, but one of the commonalities is that there is no, this is held in civil court, right? So you're not entitled to a public defender. If you can't afford an attorney, you're out of luck. You're probably going to be going up against a prosecutor, but that doesn't mean that you're entitled to legal representation, right? So that's one issue with due process. The other issue are these ex parte orders where a judge goes or a petitioner goes before a judge. The gun owner in question is not there. In fact, they're not even aware that a petition has been filed, right? So one side gets to present its case. If a judge says, okay, after hearing one side of the argument, I believe that Cam is a danger to himself or others, or even just a greater than 50% chance that Cam might pose a danger to himself or others, you can go and take Cam's guns. And in a couple weeks, we'll have a hearing, and Cam can come before me, and he can present any evidence as to why he should get his guns back. That, again, is another issue with due process, right? You don't get your day in court right away. You get your day in court after your guns have been taken. There's also typically no mental health component to a red flag law, either before or after, right? So it's not that a mental health professional were to sit down with me, we'll just use me as an example, and determine whether or not I am a danger to myself or somebody else. It's a judge making that call, right? It's a legal standard. It's not a medical diagnosis. And if, let's say, I was deemed to be a danger to myself or somebody else, no mental health services would be offered to me. Instead, I might have to show proof that I went to counseling, that I sought treatment before I can get my guns back, but that's not again, provided, right? So the state can deem somebody to be a danger to themselves or others and then say, hey, but you're on your own. We're going to take your guns away, but we're going to leave you dangerous guy alone. It doesn't make any sense to me, honestly. Now, yellow flag laws, and Maine is really the only state that has a yellow flag law, so maybe it's not correct to use the plural there. It's still not perfect, but it is better. There are more due process protections. So not everybody can apply for a yellow flag order, right? And that's another commonality with red flag laws. It starts out, generally speaking, with, you know, police, prosecutors, immediate family being able to petition the courts. And then what we've seen is that this gets expanded and broadened out so that basically anybody can file a petition against anybody else. That's not the case with the yellow flag law in Maine. It actually, the family can go to police, but it has to be initiated by law enforcement. And then once that law enforcement has taken the preliminary step, they take that individual who are going to be subject to a yellow flag order, and they do get a mental health evaluation. And only after that mental health evaluation can the process of temporarily removing their firearms continue. So, again, it's not perfect, but I think it is better than the lack of due process protections that are inherently a part of red flag laws. Now, again, my main issue is that they still don't, neither the yellow flag law nor the red flag law addresses the dangerousness of an individual, right? In both cases, the goal is to temporarily remove firearms from that person who's deemed to be dangerous. But they don't do anything to address the dangerousness itself. And they leave that supposedly dangerous person with access to all kinds of other implements that they could use to harm themselves or others, whether it be knives, car keys, gasoline, ropes, whatever. They're also free to illegally acquire a firearm, right? Because they're not in custody. They're not getting mental health treatment. It is not a, to me, it's not the right approach. It is a gun control law masquerading as a mental health or public safety initiative. Now, one of the knocks about the yellow flag law in Maine is that it wasn't used a lot. And in fact, in the shooting in Lewiston, Maine, the independent commission that investigated that shooting found that local law enforcement had cause to initiate a yellow flag order, but they never took those steps. Gun control activists have said, well, it's because it's too difficult. That's why we need to swap out the yellow flag law with a red flag law. But as the Portland Press Herald reports, after that shooting in Lewiston, the state ramped up training for local police departments. The yellow flag law is now being used far more frequently, 412 times in the year following the shooting, compared to only being used 34 times in the preceding 3 years. Portland Press Herald also notes that a last-minute red flag bill was proposed in the House of Representatives this year, but never received a floor vote, leaving the current law in place. They note that the gun owners and mills have defended the current law, saying that due process provisions are necessary to protect the law from a constitutional challenge, and they point to increased use as proof that the yellow flag law is effective. Well, I won't say that the increased use shows that the yellow flag law is effective, but I think it does show that the complaints of gun control advocates that the law is too burdensome, too cumbersome to be used, are not true. If you've seen, again, this 34 yellow flag petitions in the 3 years before the Lewiston shooting, and now 412 in the 1 year since the shootings in Lewiston, no, clearly law enforcement has figured out, excuse me, how to use this yellow flag law, even if there was some concern beforehand. And there were some tweaks made to the yellow flag law by the legislature. One of the issues that had come up, and it might be a legitimate issue, is that while the yellow flag law required a mental health evaluation, Maine, like most states, has a shortage of mental health workers, right? So there were some hospital systems that apparently had opted out. They just didn't even want to be a part of this. And so it was kind of challenging to get an individual who was, again, subject to one of these petitions before a mental health professional for that evaluation. Now I think they're able to use telemedicine. They've also got, I think, more buy-in from mental health professionals in the state of Maine. So it's easier, apparently, to get that aspect of the law in place and in use, right? Again, I am not a fan of yellow flag laws. I'm not stumping for a Maine's yellow flag law. I still think, again, that it misses the bigger issue when we're dealing with somebody who is supposedly a danger to themselves or others. But having said that, between a yellow flag law and a red flag law, I think Maine's is the far better approach. And one, frankly, if states are going to adopt measures like this, an approach that provides more due process protection that actually does involve the mental health of the petitioner and offers that individual the opportunity for treatment, if they in fact are a danger to themselves or others, that is a much better approach than saying, you know what, we think you might be a problem, so we're going to take your guns away and then we're going to leave you alone, even though we think you might be dangerous. I don't think that helps anybody. So we know that a red flag law is going to be one of the major issues for gun control activists in Maine next session. We may very well see a proposed ban on so-called assault weapons as well. You know, one of the races we were looking at in the election was Jared Golden and Austin Thrall in Maine's. I believe this was the second congressional district. You know, Golden had come out in favor of a ban on so-called assault weapons after the Lewiston shootings. Thrall had opposed that ban. Very, very close election. I think, honestly, the difference maker for Jared Golden, who won re-election, was just the advantage of incumbency. But because somebody who supported a ban on so-called assault weapons was not defeated in the elections in Maine last week, I think that gun control activists are going to try to use that as a springboard to push for a semi-auto ban next year. And that's, you know, something we're going to have to pay attention to around the country, right, is what will the blue states do? And we talked about this a little bit with Alan Gottlieb on yesterday's program, right? Lashing out, throwing a temper tantrum. Even in states like Maine, which have historically been pretty pro-gun, with the Democrats in control and anti-gun Democrats in particular wanting to have an impact. Yeah, I think Maine and what the Maine Gun Safety Coalition is hoping to do, I think that's a canary in the coal mine for anti-gun efforts at the state level next year. All right, let's turn our attention now to today's Armed Citizen story, our good deed of the day, and our recidivist report. We'll start there. Not really a true recidivist report. I don't know if these teenagers had any previous criminal history, but they were sentenced in such a head-scratching manner. Here's the headline. Two teens involved in stabbing at West High School take plea deal. This was in Iowa City, Iowa. The incident happened back in August, around 8 p.m. The school was closed. It's still unclear how these teens were in the school. But according to KCRG, police say three teens chased down a victim in the hallway of West High School and then punched them, kicked them, stabbed them multiple times while the teenage victim was lying defenseless on the ground. 16-year-old Moyad Elseed of Iowa City, 17-year-old Tian Exum Carson of Coralville, Iowa, both charged with one count of third-degree burglary and one count of willful injury for the incident. Elseed was supposed to go to trial today, but he took a plea deal on Friday, and Exum Carson took a similar plea deal the day before, last Thursday. Both teens, according to KCRG, have been placed on supervised probation for 3 years. So for violently and viciously assaulting a teenager, again, punching, kicking, and stabbing that individual multiple times, according to law enforcement, no jail time, no time spent in juvenile detention, in intensive rehabilitation, no, just supervised probation. The other teen charged, 16-year-old Nathaniel Washington of Iowa City. By the way, since the fact that these teenagers' names are released, I am assuming that they're being charged as adults in this case, because otherwise I would think that their names would not be released to the public, which again makes that probation sentence even more inexplicable to me. But yeah, two of the three perpetrators of this attack walking away with a slap on the wrist. The third, I guess, has not yet gone to trial, likely to take a plea deal as well, I have to assume. We'll keep our eyes open for any updates and see if they are reported in the local press or if this story is simply, you know, now done and gone and quickly forgotten. Today's Armed Citizen story from Florida, where an armed burglary suspect shot by a homeowner's son in Hillsborough County. This was over the weekend. I think it was early Sunday morning. About 12:20 Sunday morning at a home in Ruskin, Florida. It's about 20 miles south of Tampa. Hillsborough County Sheriff's Office says when deputies arrived on the scene, they found the suspect deceased from multiple gunshot wounds. Suspect identified as 46-year-old Tony Say. The sheriff's office said that Say was armed with a handgun at the time. And detectives determined that the homeowner's adult son shot the suspect after he broke into the home. Hillsborough County Sheriff Chad Cronister said in a news release, "Imagine the fear of being awoken in the middle of the night to a stranger invading your home." Saying this is every homeowner's greatest fear, a dangerous and brazen individual breaking in, showing a complete disregard for the safety and security of others. And adding that our thoughts are with this family as they recover from the trauma of this event. So again, don't have a ton of details there, but we know the important facts, right? The guy, armed with a gun, tries to break into a home in the middle of the night, somewhere he was not allowed to be, and a armed citizen acting in defense of himself and his mom, perhaps other family members as well, stopping the threat. And yeah, I'm sure this is a traumatic event for the family, right? Even the act of shooting somebody in self-defense is traumatic. As gun owners, I've said this before, it's been a while, but I'll say it again. I no more want to use one of my guns in self-defense or in defense of my family that I want to break out the fire extinguisher that stays in my kitchen and use it to stop my house from burning down, right? I will be perfectly happy if I go my entire life and I never have to use that fire extinguisher to save my home. And I will be perfectly happy if I go my entire life and I never have to use my gun or one of my guns to protect myself or the people that I love. In fact, I kind of hope that's what happens, that on my deathbed, I can say, glad I never had to use it, but I'm awfully glad I had it. So, yes, even this act of self-defense is traumatic, and I hope that the family is able to move on and get some help. But as traumatic as this is, the alternative would be even more devastating for that family. All right. Finally today, our good deed of the day, from Newport News, Virginia. Headline, a lunchroom lifesaver, a student saved from choking on a kiwi, of all things, by the way, but in the right place, at the right time, willing and able to do the right thing. A Army veteran and a school security officer who was able to help that teen. Daniel Roldan is his name. He's the lead security officer at Ella Fitzgerald Middle School. And a couple of days ago, he saw 7th grader Matthew Hsu struggling. In fact, Hsu actually walked up to him and kind of signaled like, "Hey, I can't breathe." Had his hands on his throat. Eyes were, you know, big and wide. So Roldan immediately asked for Richard Frank to intervene. Frank said, "I just went full force. Started doing the Heimlich maneuver." He said, "I went underneath his sternum. And I started just boom, 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 boom." He said, "The sixth time I felt and I heard him gasp for air. And so I stopped. I'm rubbing his chest and I just said, 'It's going to be all right. It's going to be all right. It's going to be all right.'" And it was. Matthew is okay. And his parents, actually, I recently went to Ella Fitzgerald Middle School to say thanks, Officer Frank, in person. Rachel Corneliuson said, "Just hearing the swift actions of Officer Frank, hearing him saving our son, thanks is just never going to be enough." His stepfather, Suede Corneliuson, said that he's glad that there are still people in the world who are selfless. Frank, who also It goes by the name of Tank, right? Tank the Frank, or Frank the Tank, I guess. Said, I worked in the cemetery business for 24 years. He said, I buried children that I knew. And I wanted to make a difference in someone's lives and in the kids' lives. He said, and I happened to become a security officer. And now I make a difference every day, not just in his life, but in the thousands of kids I meet every day. I make a difference. Absolutely. Might not always save a life, but every day is an opportunity to, help guide those kids in a positive direction. So, Richard Frank, the Tank, Daniel Rolden, the elite security officer at Ella Fitzgerald Middle School there in Newport News, Virginia, we thank you both for your very, very good deeds. All right, that is going to do it for this edition of Bearing Arms, Cam & Company. I want to thank you, as always, for being a part of the program. I'm looking forward to seeing you back here again tomorrow. Don't forget, on Wednesdays, by the way, we also do our VIP Gold Live Chat with Hot Air's Ed Morrissey. I'd love for you to be a part of that. If you're not yet a VIP Gold member, just go to bearingarms.com/subscribe. You can use the promo code FIGHT and get a significant savings on your VIP, VIP Gold, or VIP Platinum membership. We got all kinds of exclusive benefits. You'll also be supporting the independent pro Second Amendment journalism that we're doing at Bearing Arms, and we really do appreciate that. Hope to see you in that live chat tomorrow, but be sure to check out bearingarms.com throughout the rest of the day today. We're keeping you up to date on all of the latest Second Amendment news and information. We've got a big court hearing in Illinois, actually, taking on Cook County's ban on so-called assault weapons. We'll be covering that and more at the website. And a great rest of your 2A Tuesday. We'll see you back here tomorrow. Until then, be well, be safe, and be free.